From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for October 16th, 2020. The undefeated Green Bay Packers are in Tampa this Sunday with Tom Brady and the Buccaneers. Pabst Blue Ribbon started brewing beer in Milwaukee in 1884. Well, PBR has a new product, cannabis-infused seltzer. Before you rush right out, you should know it's only available in dispensaries in California, but Frederick Pabst must be spinning like a lathe in his grave right about now. Well, there's irony, and then there's this. More than 1,000 workers at a factory in Sri Lanka have tested positive for coronavirus. The irony is they produce surgical masks. It's been said that a family tree in West Virginia looks more like a straight line. Well, a West Virginia woman just pleaded guilty to killing her boyfriend so that she could marry her father. Just how creepy is that? Including goat yoga, the world is full of wellness trends designed to soothe both mind and body. Well, the Dutch have a new one. It's cow hugging. That's right. Give Elsie a hug and feel better. I got to believe that's been going on in Wisconsin for years. And finally, we've all been guilty of an accidental butt dial or two. Well, a Tesla owner last August accidentally butt dialed a $4,300 autopilot upgrade. And he's still waiting for a refund. Apparently, Tesla believes no one's butt is that talented. On the podcast today, we have Brian Kill, Dave Sandstrom, Joel Driesang, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
I was a little bit concerned about how you were going to transition to us here, Max, but well done.
Segways. It's all about segways.
Yeah. Well, good week for the markets overall, despite a couple of bad days in the middle of the week here. The NASDAQ closed the week up 0.8%, closing at the bell at 11,672. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 113 points today to close at the bell, 28,607. That's 0.1% higher for the week. And the S&P 500 up 7 points only for the week, or 0.2% to close at 3,484. For the year, the Dow Jones total return, including dividends, now up 2.1%. The S&P 500 now up 9.4%. And the NASDAQ a whopping 31% after factoring in about 1% for dividends there. So again, continued strong performance from those growth stocks, especially technology stocks that populate the NASDAQ. Just an incredible run so far this year, despite what was really only a couple of bad weeks back in March. You know, maybe just a reminder that, yeah, it's one thing to have some pretty heavy allocations there, and you may have heavy allocations there only strictly because of how well things have run higher. It's another to remember that, you know, we generally believe in balance. We generally believe that things that haven't done well come back around as long as the fundamentals are strong. And so, you know, looking at that 31% number now through the 16th of October seems like a pretty juicy return on the NASDAQ. But remember that, you know, value stocks are going to have their day. You know, just to dive in here, I guess, you know, first and foremost, the piece of news today as we put a close on the fiscal year for the U.S. government, we saw what was a staggering federal deficit in the 2020 fiscal year, $3.1 trillion, obviously the largest deficit ever. But, you know, more importantly, you know, the reasons for those deficits, we didn't see significant declines in receipts. So the tax money coming in, not all that big of a change, down just 1.1%, $3.4 trillion in receipts that the federal government took in, but spending up 47% at $6.5 trillion. And again, you start to spend $600 million on a PPP loan fund. You spend hundreds of billions of dollars on, you know, other areas in terms of pandemic relief. And that money starts to add up rather quickly. And again, to the tune of a $3.1 trillion deficit. The other, I think, staggering piece that stands out is that, you know, the federal debt rose 25% in the fiscal year 2020, now standing at $21 trillion, which according to estimates is about 102% of GDP. So the first time in more than 70 years that we're above gross domestic product, annual gross domestic product with our deficit. And so, you know, Brian, I know that's a number that you keep a close eye on, obviously. Concerning, especially when you see debt relative to GDP. That's a number that a lot of economists especially look at. You know, did you have any immediate reactions to kind of seeing that news today?
Well, the first thing I thought of was, Kyle, I'm old enough to remember when we used to say a billion here and a billion there, and you're talking real money. Now it's a trillion. You know, the number of zeros behind that is staggering. But, you know, I think, Kyle, it's always a short-term versus a long-term issue. And right now we're in the middle of this pandemic and the lawmakers are trying to add enough fuel to the fire to keep the economy going to such an extent that over the long run, we recover quickly and gain that, you know, what we've thrown into the bucket back more quickly. So in the short term, it's certainly the numbers are just overwhelming, there is some long-term consequences to it all. And that's before we spend potentially another $1.8 to $2 trillion on additional stimulus. There are consequences. And as we head into election season and you hear talk of raising taxes and you hear talk of spending programs, these things all kind of become interrelated. And it'll be a bit of a puzzle to figure out as we move past the election and past the pandemic, what the long-term fiscal situation is and how we're going to deal with it as a society.
Well, Brian, I think you hit on the critical piece, and that is that, you know, there may have been some immediate need for this spending. And we've talked about the role that additional stimulus would play in keeping the economy moving. As we talk about the employment report a little later on, you know, I think that's a big thing that hangs over, you know, the need for additional stimulus is, you know, can we get 20 plus million people that were out of work at one point in time, can we get them all back to work, or how many of them are we going to get back to work? And that may tell us a little more about what kind of stimulus is still needed, if any. But again, I think the challenge is we have the understanding that the short-term spending, the spending today, is being done with the idea that long-term we can catch back up down the road. But the bigger hole you dig yourself, the more difficult that becomes. And so, you know, I think that's a number that we keep a close eye on. Certainly, it's a number that, you know, I'm particularly interested in seeing how we solve that problem.
And Kyle, I think the thing to also keep your eye on, of course, is interest rates. And when you have the ability to refinance that debt continually at these ultra low rates, you know, the 10-year treasury, you know, only paying 74 basis points at this point, it makes that type of debt number somewhat affordable during these times. I think where you're going to get yourself in some trouble is if we return back to the days of, you know, long-term average 10-year treasury paying 4 to 5%, now financing that $31 trillion is going to be a little bit more difficult to swallow.
Well, and you saw the Chinese issue a big bond, a bunch of bonds this week, and a lot of those bought up by Americans. And what'll lead to that problem, David, is if people start to buy their debt instead of ours, or if they go some other place for their source of capital. And I think these are all things we're going to have to manage. But I think certainly the priority, at least, has been on getting us through the current pandemic issue and then coming out the other end and seeing how best to dig out of the fiscal problems that we've added to in the meantime.
So, Dave, one of the big things I think that we've seen during the pandemic is these disruptive technologies, or just disruption more broadly in terms of business disruption, whether it's because businesses were shut down, losing employees, losing market share to businesses that didn't have to shut down, or whether it's that we've just suddenly found new ways to do business. But all of these, you know, have had a drastic impact on kind of the way we do business.
Yes, for sure, Kyle. And I think what's interesting is, you know, those types of technologies are always out there in any type of economy where, you know, innovation is always the goal, right, for any technology company. But you get into a situation like a global pandemic, and it's very interesting to see how a situation like this forces those future technologies to compress and come quicker than they otherwise would have. Just because out of necessity, you know, things like digital workplaces were really forced into action much faster than I think they normally would have been, you know, without something like the pandemic. So I think what's interesting about it is it gives the opportunity for places to still invest, even though obviously, unemployment numbers are concerning and the economy is, GDP numbers obviously took a big hit. But this forced innovation and this disruptive technology that we're seeing does give, the advantage to a good manager out there of a mutual fund to find those opportunities and some really interesting growth stories that are out there. And so, those are some of those silver linings, I think, that you can point to during a something like this pandemic.
Dave, I think it actually even gets beyond technology. I know we were going to come around to this later anyway, but you look at the retail numbers that came out today, and they looked really good. It's, the retail spending was up 1.9% in September, 5 months in a row that it's been up. It's past where it was before the pandemic. That 1.9% was a faster, a more accelerated rate than we had in the 2 or 3 months before that. But if you look year to year at some of the categories, one that I did a chart on looks at two categories, the food services and drinking places category and the online retail category. Online retailers in the last year have had 23.8% higher sales since September of 2019. Bars and restaurants, it's down 14.4%. So even within, and there's maybe a case of technology, but the pandemic really has made consumers rethink of what they're doing, or they're spending their money differently. And actually within retailers, there have been a lot of stores that have gone bankrupt since the pandemic. We have a new neighbor who moved here from New York who works for a big retail company. And she said that they had all their ducks in a row and their financing and their organization was such that they've actually expanded and they've, they're doing okay. And she's still working, but she's not working in New York anymore. She's working, from home, her new home here in the Milwaukee area.
Well, and I think both those things speak to kind of the nature of our economic recovery in this particular pandemic, which seems to be very much a situation of haves and have-nots. And whether it's because technologically you've innovated to take advantage of these disruptions, or whether it's just because you happen to be in a good neighborhood where you're going to, and I don't mean that literally, but where your neighborhood, I'm sure, is good, Joel. But literally where, you take the banks, look how the big banks have prospered during this pandemic. And you wouldn't normally see that, And so I think kind of the haves and have nots, we're going to see some people do really well, but you're also seeing in the unemployment numbers bear that there's still going to be a big chunk of the economy that's going to suffer. It's going to take a while for them to get back. Now, when you add it all back up, you can look ahead and see that the earnings numbers for next year are looking pretty optimistic. But I think the underlying story there is some people are really doing well and others are still going to continue to struggle.
Brian, what I think I see happening as we move beyond the current environment is that a lot of these technologies that we've embraced, a lot of the unfortunate job losses also lead to productivity growth, right? That you make the existing workers more productive because they have to be, because there's fewer people doing the same job that used to be done. I think our listeners need to remember that the math for GDP growth is simply the growth in workers plus productivity growth gets you GDP growth. Wow, that was a tough one to get out. But if you look at ultimately where we are as a country, we're not growing the workforce that much anymore. You look at the forecast, the census forecast for population growth, the working age population growth from 2020 to 2029, it's only 0.2%. And the vast majority of that is immigrant workers. And so if you're not expecting much population growth, you're already having some challenges in terms of workforce, you're not going to see a lot of growth from the workforce side of things. And so the expectation is it has to come from productivity. The bringing forward of a lot of these disruptive technologies, the focus on making workers more efficient in new ways. You know, you look at the computing revolution that took place over really the last two or three decades and how that made workers more efficient. I think the next level is the introduction of artificial intelligence, the introduction of more introduction of robotics, and just overall, you know, more flexible work environments that can make workers more efficient. And all of a sudden, you know, you can get back to 2.5 or 3% GDP growth, which seems like a dream right now, but you can get back to 2.5 or 3 just because you become more productive. And so it means that we're going to lose workers, that they're going to be phased out of their jobs because they become less relevant. It means we're going to have new employment that we need. And so training becomes incredibly important for those workers that are displaced. And so, you know, there's opportunity there. But again, I think there's a bumpy road ahead as far as how we get there. And I think as you move beyond simply employment in the economy, you start to understand this isn't simply about, you know, stocks. There's plenty of alternatives out there that are facing similar consequences. Brian, real estate's a great example of something that we've looked at where you go, okay, you know, JCPenney going out of business, Sears going out of business, that's been an absolute travesty for a lot of the large regional malls. And yet there's also some opportunity in real estate.
Yeah, you know, I heard recently that Mayfair Mall might be the only remaining retail mall in the state at some future, short-term future point. But, you know, I think, Kyle, one of the things about where we are right now is, you know, that as the virus itself is kind of spiking for a third time, you're kind of wondering what things look like in the post-election world. I do think it's always a good idea to kind of look past those things and see where the opportunities lie. And we haven't talked about real estate much, but I think the opportunities in real estate might be one of those places where we can head down the road to find both some safety and potential growth opportunities. And there's a couple of things I like about real estate. One is, you know, in the post-financial crisis world, they really shored up their balance sheets. A lot of the real estate investment trusts paid down a lot of debt or refinanced lower debts. And you compare those debt ratios to their asset values and they look pretty appealing. And certainly anything with a strong balance sheet in this environment offers some potential. And if you're looking for a dividend, those strong balance sheets and those strong cash flows offer that dividend, which is might be a nice place to supplement that income stream in your portfolio. Oftentimes, real estate can provide kind of recession-less investment ideas. You know, there are certain parts of real estate that no matter what the economy is doing, you're going to get that income stream. I think dispersion is an idea in real estate that we don't talk about a lot, but typically the difference between the good guys and the bad guys in real estate may be upwards of 60% on an annual basis. So if you pick the good spots and you avoid the bad spots, and those kinds of things are often created in these periods of disruption, you can really find some nice places to put some money in. And so I think if you look at how COVID has, and how the disruption caused from COVID has impacted real estate, we get back to this idea of, well, what happens to the shopping malls? And that's perhaps commercial office space and some of the other sectors, anything attached to leisure or travel, perhaps, that some of these are hurt very badly. But then also some are doing so well, data centers and phone towers, industrial technology. 40% of the real estate market is in those fast growing sectors of the economy. So there are certainly places to avoid, but also really good opportunities in real estate, Kyle, that I think we can perhaps take advantage of when we get a little clearer picture of where the needle's going to go.
Well, and I'm struck by your dispersion comment, and you look at, you know, some of the great areas of real estate and some of the weak areas of real estate. We look at the value and growth comparison so often and go, okay, 30, 40 percentage points in a year, that's a really big deal. But, you know, real estate is its own universe oftentimes. You know, we think of it as kind of this one little corner of the world, but it's quite diverse in and of itself. And so to be able to say, yeah, there are some real challenges facing a lot of real estate companies right now, a lot of real estate opportunities, even broad real estate sectors, but there's also a whole nother area of real estate that's got opportunity facing it. And I think, you know, maybe that's the key that you need to focus on is if you can take advantage of some of those opportunities, You know, you're finding a source of return that's different than where we've looked before. It's not simply growth or value. It's a whole nother animal to add to the portfolio.
Well, and there are parts of the, you know, kind of, if you will, the old economy. I mean, industrial sector. I mean, David, your son works for Amazon. Look what those guys are doing. They're just, you know, it's amazing how well they're faring in this downturn. And a lot of that's really, you know, they're chewing up big chunks of real estate and making opportunities out of that. Think about self-storage, Kyle. You know, these college kids moving home, they aren't in their dorms anymore, and people downsizing, people perhaps, you know, nowhere to put their office furniture because they don't need their office anymore, but self-storage businesses accelerating rapidly. That's a great place to be. And I think, how will healthcare change down the road? And people are driving through these, you know, mobile, you know, clinics to get their COVID tests and whatnot. I'm sure in some form or fashion, it'll also change the way that real estate is a part of the healthcare community. And these things are all opportunities that I think we'll get a better handle on as we continue to move forward.
Brian, you mentioned the Amazon thing. Talk about it, just kind of an ironic twist. Amazon looking at picking up a lot of the space that Sears and JCPenney are leaving vacant to use as distribution center storage places. So it's kind of funny that they may have led to some of the downturn of that brick and mortar retail, and now they're going to be the ones stepping in to save some of those facilities.
Sears Store by Us has become a big box liquor store.
It might be needed at this point. It is amazing to me that, you know, Amazon in particular, for all of the disruption that they created and for all of the businesses that were, you know, forced out of business because of that, they've had to turn around and create, you know, a lot of that then service, right? So how do you get the last mile of those deliveries, right? Well, Amazon's come out and put their own delivery fleet together. How do you have enough space to store all the things that you're selling? If people are buying more from you and less from Sears and JCPenney's, well, okay, we're going to take over those stores now so that we can store stuff a little bit closer to the end consumer. And so I do think it's one of these where, you know, you have these assets, these retail spaces, for example, and it's not necessarily a matter of them going away entirely. It's about repurposing them. It's about making them more productive than they used to be. And I think it gets back to this core idea of what the post-COVID economy looks like. It's an economy that's far more efficient because of all the pain we went through. It has to be. And it also means that down the road, you know, the next time we go through something like this, whether it's in another 10 years or another 100, you know, I think we're going to be better prepared from a consumption standpoint, at least. We're going to be better prepared to navigate those issues.
You know, Kyle, I was thinking about this today. I think I told you guys earlier, my wife in San Francisco to see my daughter and needed to get from her hotel to the COVID testing center. Now, I'm telling you that she would be the last living human being to figure out how to use Uber on her phone, but she did it today, right? So you kind of wonder how these these things change the way you look at things. You know, she's now on her app traveling around the city of San Francisco because she was forced to figure it out because of the underlying conditions caused by COVID. And I think that's how economies change abruptly. They, you know, people are forced to learn. They're forced to do things differently. They're forced to adopt and adapt to new technologies. And I think, you know, there's lots of good things to come of that down the road. So this is how we change, you know?
Joel, a lot of economic indicators this week. I think what's stood out to me is some continued weakness in the labor market, and yet got some fairly decent data on retail sales.
Yeah, Kyle, we talked about the retail sales. That was good news. The fact that, you know, it's going in the right direction, that we're, we say every week on the show that 2/3 of the gross domestic product is generated from consumer spending, and, you know, retail is one sign of that. So that's all good. And the monthly spending, I was talking a little bit about how year to year you see these disparities between online and bars and restaurants and clothing stores, for instance. But for the month of September, it was pretty broad based. There are 13 categories, 11 of them expanded. So that was good news. Yeah, the labor numbers are more disconcerting. We're about to post the video of the 2020 investment outlook seminar, and in a discussion that you and Bob had, Bob Landis was talking about, as he has on this show, how important the labor numbers are right now, as we're seeing this recovery. We're seeing several indicators that the economy is coming back. Not as much, though, on the employment front. We lost 22 million jobs when the pandemic started. We have a little more than half of them back so far. This week, you know, we get weekly numbers on new claims for unemployment insurance. And this week was the first time in 11 weeks that that four-week moving average that we watch, that it went up. So it's going in the wrong direction. And, you know, 1 week does not a trend make. But the fact that there are still 866,000 new applications for unemployment benefits doesn't speak well to the economy. And just to put that in perspective, back in February, we had 208,000, and that was a 50-year low.
Yeah, I think one of the most fascinating data points, David, you talk about this all the time, is we have roughly 11 million people looking for a job, and we have roughly 8 million jobs available that aren't filled right now. And, you know, on face value, you just want to say, hey, why don't a bunch of you guys go get a bunch of those jobs? But it's not that easy, right? Geographically, people are in different places, or skill set wise, people are in different places. And I do think one of the keys moving forward is to how to solve that riddle and get those people retrained or reacclimated to new jobs and new opportunities. And in addition to, as you mentioned to earlier, Kyle, talking about technology and increasing productivity through higher efficiency.
Right, Dave and I were looking at numbers on that last week. And one kind of a proxy for that is if you look at all the job openings, and if you look at all of the number of people who are unemployed and looking for work. Yeah, that's just, you know, the number looking for work has skyrocketed since the pandemic, and the job postings have gone down a little, but those are actually pretty high now too. And for about a year and a half, we had a phenomenon. We haven't been measuring these numbers very long, but we had a phenomenon where we actually had more openings than we had people looking for work. Well, that's just totally flip-flopped. And as far as fitting, you're right. I mean, it doesn't, you know, when I was a reporter, I covered the Great Recession and followed people who were looking for work after losing jobs. And you think about a factory worker who's been in a factory for 30 years trying to get a job in the computer age, and they have to have remedial classes in how to type, you know. So it's not always a good fit.
To kind of bring it full circle too, to our earlier discussion, we talked about disruptive technologies and explosive growth in those areas. Well, that's what's creating some of those job openings. And they're certainly not an easy way to slide in the millions of, you know, former restaurant and hotel workers to show up and start programming virtual reality programs and cashless payment systems. So yeah, that in the short run here, you can even increase that disparity because of that mismatch in skill set.
You know, I think a reminder that this isn't the first time we've gone through these kinds of disruptions. And one of the incredible things about the American worker is their ability to adapt to these new kinds of environments. And so maybe a message to policymakers out there, that to the extent you're looking at more stimulus, to the extent that you're looking at where to best spend money, maybe it's in retraining some of these workers to fill the jobs that are already out there, because you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck if you can get these people back to work quicker. These people who are more than willing to work just maybe need a little bit of training, a little push in the right direction. And ultimately, you know, the $3.5 trillion or $3.1 trillion in deficit this year, and however much more that is in terms of further stimulus spend, you know, if that's spent in the right places, that's money that we absolutely should be getting back, you know, getting dividends on that for years to come as these workers are retrained to better places. Joel, anything else from this week's economic stuff that really stands out?
We had news on inflation, not much there. We look at the capacity utilization rate for industry. That actually went down in September, and it's way down from where it was in February. It hasn't been at its average, its long-term average since 2008. So that's an indicator that inflation's around the corner. It's telling us it's not even on the street. The other thing that we had on inflation was the consumer price index, which is the broadest look at inflation. And that actually, you know, looked a little healthier. It's a sign that when you have inflation, it's a sign that, you know, the economy is growing. But as a result of the inflation numbers from the CPI this week, the Social Security Administration figured out what the raise is for the adjustment for the cost of living for Social Security would be for 2021. And they said it's going to be 1.3%. And that's compared to the average since 1975 when they started doing those COLAs of 3.6%. So on the low side, but it's better than nothing, which is what Social Security recipients got in, 2010, 2011, 2016?
Yeah, post-financial crisis was a rough stretch for inflation. And certainly, I think inflation has been kind of all over the map and, in this pandemic. But at least we're going to get a little bump for those on Social Security next year. And I know you normally put something about that in the newsletter, just as a reminder to our many investors who are looking at taking Social Security or currently taking Social Security, that they're going to get a little bump in their paycheck. Well, thank you everyone for listening. We enjoy doing the program for you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.